Hello there. Today is Thursday, December 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Liberians vote in their first democratic transfer of power in more than 70 years. The Trump administration environmental policies facing a growing number of lawsuits.
The interstate impacts of air pollution are a uniquely federal concern, and I think the courts are going to take that very seriously.
UN aid is assisting displaced people in Afghanistan as winter sets in. Also ahead, former President Barack Obama gives his first interview since leaving office. It's all on today's International Edition. Two Reuters journalists who have been detained in Myanmar for the past 2 weeks were sent back into custody Wednesday for another 2 weeks. Rosanna Philpott has details.
Two Reuters journalists detained in Myanmar for the past 2 weeks were remanded back into custody on Wednesday for a further 14 days. Hua Lone and Cho So-un appeared at a court in Yangon over allegations they breached the nation's Official Secrets Act. The two were allowed to meet their families and their lawyer for the first time since their arrest on December the 12th. The journalists had worked on Reuters' coverage of the migrant crisis, which has seen an estimated 655,000 Rohingya Muslims flee from a military crackdown in the western state of Rakhine. Myanmar's Ministry of Information has said they illegally acquired information with the intention to share it with foreign media. They could face a maximum prison sentence of 14 years. Hua Lone and Cho So-un's lawyer said they'd only been doing their job as journalists. Government officials from some of the world's major nations, including the US, Britain and Canada, have echoed calls from Reuters and their families for their release.
Again, that's Rosanna Philpott reporting. A suicide car bombing at a military base in southern Afghanistan Wednesday killed at least two soldiers and wounded 15 others. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad, Pakistan.
The attack occurred in Lashkar Gah, which is the provincial capital of the Helmand province. And there was a military base, and apparently a group of soldiers were getting ready to go and conduct a counterinsurgency operation in the nearby Marja district when two Taliban suicide bombers riding a car packed with explosives tried to ram their car into this facility, but they were intercepted at the outer gate by security forces and by a contingent of soldiers who were about to take off from that area. And what we know that several soldiers have died as a result of this powerful explosion, and more than 15 have been wounded. But these are initial reports because it happened very late afternoon and few details have emerged since then.
He says during the harsh winter weather in Afghanistan, the Taliban scales back its battlefield attacks and relies more on suicide bombings and guerrilla-type attacks. Ghul says there have been many in recent weeks, particularly in southern Afghanistan, the largest province, which is known for producing opium poppy, which is known to fund the Taliban's activities. And as winter sets in, the United Nations Refugee Agency plans to distribute aid to more than 2,700 needy families and internally displaced people in the western Afghan province of Herat. Many of the displaced come from nearby Afghan provinces where ongoing fighting and insecurity have made it impossible to remain in their homes. John Walker narrates this report by Khalil Nourzai on their plight from a camp in Herat City.
The challenges are almost too many to count for those who have fled violence near their homes and sought shelter here in Herat City.
I have so many problems. I don't have a place to live, and I have two handicapped sons who can't work, so I have to work to make a living.
In hopes of providing some relief, the United Nations and local Afghan officials launched a winter distribution program on December 17th, giving money and supplies to nearly 3,000 families who are either internally displaced people, IDPs, or have been repatriated to Afghanistan.
The program also provides aid to Herat's needy families, as well as people with special needs.
$200 and four blankets are provided to every family, Afghan officials say the government will try to grant plots of land to people so they can build homes for themselves.
All IDPs will receive a land lot. The most vulnerable IDPs, including women and children, will receive special attention.
Some of the displaced who have received aid say living conditions here are harsh and that the help will not last long, especially during the winter season.
My only son, who was the breadwinner and was serving in Afghanistan Army in Qalaynaw, capital of Badghis province, was killed in service. My husband can hardly make a living for our family.
Others are calling on the government to bring peace to their provinces so they can return home.
The government should provide security in our villages and provinces so we can go back to our farms, start farming and make a living. We are living a refugee life inside our own country.
The Herat Provincial Department of Refugees and Repatriations says more than 14,000 refugees, including 10,000 IDPs, are living in various camps and shelters in Herat. For Khalil Norzai in Herat, I'm John Walker, VOA News.
Hi, here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Russia's foreign minister defends Syria's peace conference. U.S. and Russia agree to continue diplomacy over North Korea. A new poll finds former President Obama and Hillary Clinton retaining status as the world's most admired man and woman. And fishermen in Mexico shoot down an environmental group's drone. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Liberians went to the polls on Tuesday for a presidential election they hope will mark their first democratic transfer of power in more than seven decades, despite allegations of fraud. Scarlett Sitanovich reports.
Election officials in Liberia counting votes by torchlight. Polls shut late on Tuesday in a presidential runoff, which authorities hope will mark the first democratic transfer of power in the African country in more than 70 years. Former World Footballer of the Year, George Weah, is squaring up against Vice President Joseph Boakai for the top job. Both of them promised to tackle poverty and corruption. They're bidding to succeed Alan Johnson Sirleaf in a runoff vote delayed for more than a month after Boakai and another candidate alleged widespread fraud in October's first round of polls. However, the Supreme Court rejected that challenge earlier this month.
So far, the election process...
The National Elections Commission confirmed no major disruptions occurred in the runoff and voting was better organised than last time. Weah won in October with a 9-point lead over Boakai, who has found it hard to convince voters he will bring change, given he worked alongside Johnson Sirleaf for 12 years. Her rule cemented peace in the West African country after civil war ended in 2003 and brought in much-needed aid. But critics, including many of the country's young voters, say her administration was weighed down by corruption and she did little to raise most Liberians out of dire poverty. Weah has won the hearts of mostly young people through his football performances. However, some are wary about his lack of political experience, education and concrete policy. Whether those worries will trump hope for change will be answered in results expected in the next few days.
That's Scarlett Sitanovich reporting. Donald Trump campaigned as a booster of fossil fuels and a skeptic of climate change science, and his policies over the past year have reflected those views. 2017 in climate and energy policy under the Trump administration has outraged environmentalists. Joining us now to talk more about it is Jeffrey Gracer, principal attorney with the New York-based environmental law group Sive, Padgett, and Reisel. Jeff, we've seen the U.S. pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, the deregulating of rules on water, carbon emissions, endangered species, and others. How significant has all of this been?
In terms of the deregulation effort, I would say the jury is still out because a lot of those efforts are either already in the courts or soon to be in the courts, and the courts will be taking, I think, a very close look at whether the administration has followed the rules under the Administrative Procedure Act to walk back either prior proposals in the Obama administration or final rules. So that is very much, I think, still an open question as to how much of that will stick. And I think that the courts are going to be skeptical about a lot of these efforts. In terms of the EPA, there is a normal turnover in administrations, and you know, even under Obama, there were more than 1,000 EPA employees who took buyouts or other reductions. But I think it's fair to say that for EPA employees who spent most of their careers in the agency, and I would say employees of both parties and employees with many different points of view, this is a really challenging environment for many of them, particularly for scientists.
Right. I know we've lost a lot of scientists, several hundred, some of them even being offered jobs to come work in France. That can't be good.
I don't think it's good for actions by an agency that are under the law are supposed to be grounded in science and reasonably objective analysis. And there is an inquisitorial aspect to what's going on, including recent reports that PA had retained a firm to investigate employees. There is a bit of, you know, an auto da fe for employees as to whether they are going to be adhering to whatever the beliefs of the current administration are, even if they have no basis in science. That is troubling. But I think that there are also a number of employees at EPA that are there that have decided to stay, even in a very hostile environment, and are doing their jobs. And I think they deserve a lot of praise for their patriotic dedication to environmental protection. And a lot of people have just decided that they're going to stick it out. And I think that there will be enough people like that in the agency that the agency will survive this. There will be people on the other side of this chapter in our history that remain at the agency and remain dedicated to the mission of the agency.
Well, you mentioned lawsuits, that a lot of this stuff that's been overturned and reversed has been in litigation. And we just heard this week that 8 eastern U.S. states are suing the EPA, demanding it orders tougher controls over some of the Midwestern states that they say are blowing air pollution eastward. How significant is that? Or is that just one more lawsuit?
I think it's a significant case, and I think that the interstate impacts of air pollution are a uniquely federal concern, and I think the courts are going to take that very seriously. I also think that the youth climate lawsuit, which was just argued in the Ninth Circuit, is a very important lawsuit to watch. This is a litigation brought by children basically alleging that the federal government has failed to protect them from harm that rises to the level of constitutional harm by failing to address air pollution and climate change. That case and many other cases of similar nature are percolating not only here in the U.S., but in other parts of the world.
What hope can we take away from all of this?
Well, I think one of the positives out of all of this is that a lot of corporations that really want a stable environmental regulatory system here and around the world are quite concerned about the sharply partisan attacks on the value of environmental regulation, and really feel that it does a disservice to the cause of sustainable business to assume that every corporation would be hostile to environmental protection. And they're becoming more and more vocal in their defense of the EPA, in their defense of state environmental regulators, and in their defense of the rule of law as it applies, and their extremely strong action to rally around the Paris Agreement and to appear in force and bond with their colleagues in state and local governments to make the case that Washington doesn't really speak for corporate America or for the vast majority of Americans. Those voices have been very important on the international stage, and I think that people in the international community understand that what's happening in Washington is not representative of mainstream thought in America.
That's Jeff Gracer, principal attorney with the New York-based environmental law group, Sive, Paget, and Rizel. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we take a look at the latest social media news. For that, we're joined by VOA's Doug Bernard. Hi, Doug. I guess social...
Well, of course, Lori, it is the holiday week here in the United States between Christmas on Monday and New Year's on Monday. So news is a little slow here in the United States. But, of course, that doesn't mean that people aren't still talking on social media because Lord knows they have to keep talking about something. So there's two stories I wanted to bring to your attention today that are getting a lot of attention. The first, President Obama has given one of his first interviews, if not his first broadcast interview, since leaving the Oval Office. And of all people, he gave it to Prince Harry of England. Prince Harry was sort of sitting in as an editor, if you will, at BBC Four. The two sat down and had a discussion about a number of things. They talked about the Invictus Games. They talked about social media and its possible dangers or, you know, concerns about its overuse, a number of serious topics. But, of course, the one thing that people just have to keep talking about on social media is Prince Harry's wedding. He's getting married to Meghan Markle in May, the American. And so now all the talk on social media is Mr. Obama going to be invited to the wedding or not? Lots of people weighing in. Of all people here, Joy Reid, who is a news anchor here, a cable anchor in the United States, she said, "This is just so silly. Let them invite who they want to invite. Everything doesn't have to be about Trump." Well, perhaps, but at least for some people, it's about Trump. Down here, just two tweets down, Oliver Ragg writes, if that's his name, that's his handle. He writes that Mr. Obama is clearly just hurt by all the attention and all the success that Mr. Trump is having while in office. Besides, his legacy, meaning Mr. Obama's legacy, is largely getting undone anyway. So whether it is or isn't, it seems to certainly be a lot about Trump and Obama for people. And also another story very quickly, a bit of a sad story, but it's hard to be too sad about this one. Today marks 1 year to the day that actress Carrie Fisher died. Of course, Carrie Fisher, well known from her work in Star Wars and a lot of other work as well, and in addition to the books that she wrote, her one-woman play that she had on Broadway, just a beloved figure. Lots and lots of people using the hashtag #CarrieOnForever, tweeting out great photos, funny quotes from her. They're almost always funny quotes from Carrie Fisher. So a lot of people still, 1 year later, expressing their affection for a longtime public figure and actress here in the United States, Carrie Fisher.
All right. Thanks, Doug. You can follow him on Twitter at @DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you think of the moon, you may think of it as some cold, dry, and lifeless rocky orb pocked with craters. But a new NASA study suggests that the moon once had an atmosphere. The study shows that the moon was volcanically active between 3 and 4 billion years ago. Gases produced by the flowing lava would rise above the moon's surface faster than they were able to make it into space. As a result, the study suggests these volcanic gases accumulated around the moon, forming a temporary atmosphere. NASA scientists, after analyzing volcanic moon rock samples gathered by Apollo astronauts, found they contained a variety of gases such as sulfur and carbon monoxide. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, the seven-day festival of Kwanzaa is underway. It's a time when African Americans highlight their heritage. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan has more.
Among the central rituals of Kwanzaa is the lighting of a candle for each of the 7 days of the celebration. At a cultural festival at the California African American Museum, Babe Evans explains the principles behind the upcoming holiday to a group of children. The first principle, she says, is unity.
Umoja. It means a time of repose. It means a time to think about your ancestors, to think about the struggles that people have been through so that you can now have a life that is much more open.
Kwanzaa is based on African themes, but was started in the United States in the 1960s. Its principles are stated in the Swahili language, and the name Kwanzaa comes from a phrase meaning first fruits of the harvest.
The second day, because it's a 7-day ceremony, is Kujichagulia. And that means self-determination.
Collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. These round out the seven principles of Kwanzaa. Gift-giving is a part of the holiday, but actor Jeffrey Anderson Gunther says the celebration has not become commercialized like Christmas.
When in Kwanzaa, we make our gifts. All the kids will make something and give to each other, and then we have an abundance of food and stuff that's shared.
Many people celebrate their Christian or Muslim holidays or the feast days of other faiths and then celebrate Kwanzaa as well, says writer Marsha Bullock, whose family is Christian.
We do Christmas, and then we do Kwanzaa starts like directly the day after, so we do that too. And then, my favorite part is the celebration where you get to eat everything.
The festival will end January 1st with a feast with friends and family. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Ed Sheeran's duet with Beyoncé is topping the charts for the end of 2017. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details as this year comes to a close.
What I've got for you today is the artist with the number one song for the end of the year, which is a big honor to have. Every artist is out to finish the year with a number one song, especially in the UK, where it's important to be the Christmas number one song. So Ed Sheeran has accomplished his goal. Congratulations to Ed Sheeran. His new song, Perfect, which is interesting because he's got three versions of it out. So it's the second version, the one he recorded along with Beyoncé, that is the number one song for the third straight week and will finish 2017 at number one for Ed Sheeran. Now, this song, by the way, has not only been something that reached number one for him, but earlier this year, Shape of You off of the Divide album also went to number one, and it was number one 12 weeks in the U.S., 14 weeks in the U.K., 16 weeks in Canada, tying a record there. And so he's just been the hottest artist to watch this past year. So let's check out Ed Sheeran with Beyoncé, and this is called Perfect.
When I saw you in that dress, looking so beautiful, I don't deserve this, darling, you look perfect tonight.
Larry, so why do you think that Beyoncé seemed to, what did she bring to this recording?
That's a great question, Sarah. You know, Beyoncé brings in a whole new audience, obviously. There's the R&B crowd, there's the Beyoncé fans. She's the Queen Bee. Her fans are known as the Beehive. So she brings with her the aura of being Beyoncé. And you couple that with the attraction of being Ed Sheeran, and you have two superpowers together. So, you know, Beyoncé's lended her services to J Balvin on Mi Gente, and she's recorded a couple of songs with a couple of other artists. DJ Khaled, they did a song. So there's a number of songs, and every time that you add someone like a Beyoncé, the curiosity factor goes up, the interest goes up, and of course you got the fans who are the loyalists, and that is a major component as well. So that's the Beyoncé factor, for lack of a better term, because, you know, his song Perfect, just as himself, did okay, but it wasn't until he added Beyoncé, and he's got another version with Andrea Bocelli, and it's not doing as well either. So it's that Beyoncé thing that kind of, you know, is undeniable.
A good decision to enlist her.
An absolutely a great decision. He didn't expect it was going to happen. He said that he emailed her. That's how he approached her. You know, you go through the channels, the connections that he's got through the record industry, gets the email address, sends the email, and says, yeah, Beyoncé's not, she's going to say I'm busy or, you know, whatever. She wrote back and said, yeah, I'd love to do it. In fact, not only that, she wrote back with some ideas on what they could do together, and so that got Ed very excited, and the song was inspired by Ed's girlfriend, Cherry Seaborn. The two of them have been dating since primary school, and so it's a great version of a great song, and it's right at the top where it should be.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I don't deserve it. You look perfect tonight.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains deeply concerned over the dire humanitarian conditions of the Venezuelan people brought about by the authoritarian regime of Nicolas Maduro. These hardships include lack of access to affordable food, vital medicine, and medical supplies. Malnutrition and a rise in malaria cases are among other harsh realities. According to press reports, those of limited means are being hit hard by the economic situation in Venezuela. Families are going hungry, and reports indicate child mortality rates have increased in the past years. Infant formula has become increasingly scarce or unaffordable. In addition, some children choose to take their chances living on the streets rather than remain hungry at home. All of this in a country that has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. But years of economic mismanagement and theft by the ruling Maduro elite of the country's wealth has led to the country's inability to reap the benefits of substantial oil reserves. A 2016 survey by three Venezuelan universities found that 9 out of 10 households had become food insecure in Venezuela. The United States stands ready to provide emergency assistance, including food and nutrition commodities, to affected populations. These provisions, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, could be made available immediately if only the government of Venezuela would accept international humanitarian assistance. We repeat our call on the Maduro regime to stop denying the needs of its people and to allow aid from the international community to reach them, said Ms. Nauert. U.S. sanctions do not prohibit Americans from providing food, medicine, and other humanitarian assistance to the Venezuelan people. Ms. Nauert stressed that U.S. sanctions are not directed at the people of Venezuela, nor need they remain permanent. Our sanctions can be adjusted for those who support Venezuela's return to a democratic and constitutional path, explained Ms. Nauert. But without changes forthcoming from the Maduro regime, additional measures remain under active consideration, warned spokesperson Nauert. In the meantime, it is incumbent on the Venezuelan government to immediately permit the inflow of humanitarian assistance to its people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.